Welcome to Go Gray Dame on Talk Zone. Dame is a title given to women, the equivalent to knight. This show honors our dames and inspires you to embrace your third act of life. Now, here's the host of Go Gray Dame, Renee Steelman.
Hello. Hello, and welcome to Go Gray Dame. I am so happy to talk to you today. Let me tell you, it's one of those weeks where it starts out and you're like, oh, wow, this is great. I don't have that much going on. I have a few things on my calendar, but nothing that I can't handle. And, you know, Monday went pretty well. And then Tuesday, it all fell apart. And here I am Wednesday, sitting here with an ice pack on my back. So I don't know if I should tell you about that or not. Maybe I will. Maybe I'll take it on later on. But I'm excited because today, and it actually kind of ties in with what I wanted to talk about today. We're going to highlight, as I mentioned last time, we're going to highlight Sue Monk Kidd's book, The Dance of the Dissident Daughter. I cannot recommend this book enough. It is a book that should be given out to all females, and I'm trying to guess what the age would be. I would say maybe entering middle school or junior high. This should be a mandatory book that is required reading for all females. Just to give you a little bit of an insight, this is what she says. I was going along doing everything I should have been doing, and then unexpectedly, I woke up. I collided with the patriarchy within my culture, my church, my faith tradition, my marriage, and also within myself. And this collision changed everything. I began to wake up to a whole new way of being a woman. I took what seemed to me then and seems to be now as an immense journey. And that's how she begins. And it definitely, I actually watched some of her presentations that she's given on YouTube, and she's amazing. I have to take a drink of water. I've been on the phone all morning. So one of the things that she says or said in one particular presentation that I watched was that she found herself being homesick for herself. She said, I was homesick for myself. And she talked about how as a child, she had announced to her family that she was going to be a writer and that she had tried to talk her brothers into getting a neighborhood newspaper going. And she just knew, she knew that about herself. She knew that she wanted to be a writer. But then she said, as often women do, she abandoned her dreams. And she, as she got older, she decided that nursing would be the profession that she should go into. And she went into nursing because she admired it. She really thought that it was a wonderful profession. And she was, you know, living in the mid-60s, which was a time where there were very few options for women to take on if they wanted to do something besides be a homemaker. And so she completed her degree in nursing, and she worked for a long time, and she got married, and she had two children. And then she said she still had this sense of yearning inside. And one day, she walked into the kitchen. Her husband and her two children were sitting at the table eating their cereal, and she announced to her family that she was going to be a writer. And they kind of looked at her like, okay, in the meantime, where's the Cheerios? And she said, you know, we all need a great absurdity moment. We all probably have had that type of a moment where we announce to the world that we're going to do something, or we profess that we are something. And she said it still took a long time for her to do this, what she wanted to do. But she made this announcement, and she announced to her family what her true self was and what her true calling was. And so she decided that she needed to have a place where she could begin her writing. And she says, a woman must have a room of her own. And she said, you need to cultivate your belonging. I love the way she said that. We all need to cultivate a place for our belonging. And I think often for women, we find ourselves being described to us by roles that are given to us by outside forces, whether it's a religion or a family practice or traditions, or maybe even we don't know subconsciously where we've received our role or our truth of what our value is or even what our purpose is. And so she describes how that's especially true for women, because culturally that's often we live and we are swimming in whatever culture we happen to be living in. And so she said she decided to start writing, and she would, as she was writing, she would say, "Oh, wait, I can't say that." And then she said she remembered hearing a talk or reading something, and she said that a writer writes things that can't be said. I'm paraphrasing that immensely, but basically that's what she's saying. A true writer writes what can't be said, but has to be said. And so she began her process. I love when she talks about women needing a room of their own. And I think that's so true. They need to have a place where you can use your creativity, because I believe, and again, this is my own feelings, I believe that creativity is a form of spirituality. And I like, one time I heard her say something, she referenced the point that for her, reading books and writing is a spiritual experience for her. It is a form of prayer for her. And I think that's true. When you talk about meditating or what you go through consciously or unconsciously when you're praying, there is nothing better than if you feel like you are a writer inside, there's nothing better than expressing those thoughts and those feelings on paper, and how cathartic that can be and inspiring or even motivating. So I really, really loved her quote. One of the things that I wanted to read to you from her book is in the very beginning, she tells kind of the story of how the Dance of the Dissident Daughter actually started. And I have the habit of downloading books and listening to them on audio. And then I find within just a few pages that I'm usually buying the book so that I can actually hold it in my hand. And I love to, and I can highlight sometimes, like in this case, in this particular book, I have this book in all three forms. I have the Audible version, I have a Kindle version, and I have the actual paper book. Because I just love it so much and I want to be able to access it at any time. But in the very beginning, in chapter one, she says, "It was autumn and everything was turning loose. I was running errands that afternoon. Rain had fallen earlier, but now the sun was out, shining on the tiny beads of water that cling to trees and sidewalks. The whole world seemed red and yellow and rinsed with light. I parked in front of the drugstore where my daughter Anne, 14, had an after-school job. Leaping a puddle, I went inside. I spotted her right away, kneeling on the floor in the toothpaste section, stocking a bottom shelf. I was about to walk over and say hello when I noticed two middle-aged men walking along the aisle toward her. They looked like everybody's father. They had moussed hair, and they wore knit sport shirts the color of Easter eggs, the kind of shirts with tiny alligators sewn at the chest. It was a detail I would remember later as having ironic symbolism. My daughter did not see them coming. Kneeling on the floor, she was intent on getting the boxes of Crest lined up evenly. The men stopped, peering down at her. One man nudged the other. He said, 'Now that's how I like to see a woman, on her knees.' The other man laughed. Standing in the next aisle, I froze. I watched the expression that crept into my daughter's eyes as she looked up. I watched her chin drop and her hair fall across her face. Seeing her kneel at these men's feet while they laughed at her subordinate posture pierced me through. For the previous couple of years, I had been in the midst of a tumultuous awakening. I had been struggling to come to terms with my life as a woman, in my culture, my marriage, my faith, my church, and deep inside myself. It was a process not unlike the experiences of conception and labor. There had been a moment, many moments really, when truth seized me and I conceived myself as woman. Or maybe I reconceived myself. At any rate, it had been extraordinary and surprising to find myself, a conventionally religious woman in my late 30s, suddenly stuck, pregnant with a new consciousness, with an unfolding new awareness of what it means to be a woman and what it seems to be spiritual as a woman. Hard labor had followed. For months I'd inched along, but lately I'd been stuck. I'd awakened enough to know that I couldn't go back to my old way of being a woman, but the fear of going forward was paralyzing. So I'd paddled along, trying to make room for the new consciousness that was unfolding in my life, but without really risking change. She goes on to say that the men's laughter seemed to go on and on. I felt like a small animal in the road, blinded by the light of a truck, knowing some terrible collision is coming, but unable to move. I stared at my daughter on her knees before these men and could not look away. Somehow she seemed more than my daughter. She was my mother, my grandmother, and myself. She was every woman ever born, bent and contained in a small, ageless cameo that bore the truth about a woman's place. In the profile of my daughter, I saw the suffering of women, the confining of the feminine to places of inferiority, and I experienced a collision of love and pain so great I had to reach for the counter to brace myself. I walked toward them. "I have something to say to you, and I want you to hear it," I said. They stopped laughing. Anne looked up. "This is my daughter," I said, pointing to her, my finger shaking with anger. "You may like to see her and other women on their knees, but we don't belong there. We don't belong there." Isn't that a fabulous way to start a book? And I love the fact that she talked about how she had been working as a nurse and how she was now in her 30s, and she was having this kind of revolution inside herself, trying to decide what her place was. And why this book means so much to me and why it touched me so much was because I too was probably 32 or 33. And I had as well kind of formed my life and formed my path in a way that had been laid out for me. And so that's kind of what I'm going to talk about. We're going to take a little break. And then when we come back, I want to share a little bit with you about my story and why I'm doing this podcast and what I hope you will get out of listening to my story, Sue Monk Kidd's story, and hopefully a lot of other women who will be sharing their story with you. So we'll talk in a few minutes.
Now, more of Go Gray Dame with Renee Steelman on Talk Zone.
Okay, we're back. One of the people that Sue Monk Kidd quoted in one of her presentations was a French novelist named Emile Zola. And what he said was, one of the things that she quoted was, "If you ask me what I came into this life to do, I will tell you, I came to live out loud." And I love that. I wonder how many little girls or how many women have been told that they came to this earth to live out loud. I feel as though it's the absolute opposite, that so many times women are told that they came into this world to serve others, to be a support system for others, and to be a nurturer. So I love that phrase. And I actually think that Brené Brown has actually taken that live out loud and rephrased it and used it as her own. But I can't quote Brené Brown enough. But let me tell you, so in my mid-30s, we had completed our family. I had my last child when I was 32. He was our number 6. And he had a very difficult birth. And the result of his struggle with being born was that he suffered brain damage and was eventually diagnosed as having cerebral palsy. He wasn't diagnosed until he was almost 8 or 9 months old. And up until then, the difficulties that he was having were being kind of summed up as, oh, he was a little premature, or, you know, he did have a diaphragmatic hernia when he was born, which means he had a hole in his diaphragm, which allowed his intestines and other organs to, they slipped through that hole and they were actually lying in his chest cavity. And they were taking up the space that was needed for his lungs to develop. So because the space was too crowded, he only had one lung that was developed. The other lung was just a little lung bud. So he wasn't able to breathe when he was born because of the lack of oxygen, and actually because of his birth process in general. He did have oxygen deprivation, which caused the brain damage, and therefore has a permanent disability. He will be 36 in December, and the events that you go through when you have a child with severe disabilities are life-changing for sure. He, again, as I mentioned, was our youngest child. I had 5 other children to take care of, and most of my children are not quite 2 years apart. I have a couple of 18-month apart babies. So my kids were very close together. When he was born, my oldest was 9 and a half. And so it was a busy, busy time, and it was a very stressful time. And my husband was also very busy processing his career and providing for a family and doing all kinds of things. And one of the things that kept us both very busy was we were very heavily involved in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, otherwise known as Mormon. And if any of you know anything about the Mormon religion, first of all, they don't want to call themselves Mormon anymore, but I continue to use that because I do think it's a tagline or a nickname that is very common and that people recognize easily. So, but one of the things about the Mormon Church is that they have a lay ministry, and they don't have paid anything. The teachers, the piano players, the preachers, all of the positions that are filled in this religion are volunteer, except for the very top people in Salt Lake. They do have a paid position. But because this is a volunteer system, and when I say volunteer, that's kind of an ironic term, because even though it's volunteer, the feeling and the theocracy that goes along with it is that you have been called to do whatever you're asked to do by God. So there, you really don't feel as though you have a choice, because you feel as though you have been given a path or an opportunity directly from God to be a teacher or to hold any kind of authoritative position. So my husband was very busy in his career, and he also held callings and positions at church, and I did as well. So I'm raising 6 children, but I'm also teaching a young women's class or a Sunday school class or something like that. So it's very, very time consuming. We were very, very busy. And I just think the pressure of even if we weren't heavily involved in a fundamental religion, I think just the pressure of having 6 children is enough to put people over the edge. But having a child with severe disabilities doesn't help. And the other thing about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is they believe in a restored gospel book called the Book of Mormon, which is where they got their nickname. And this book is held very high in the religion. And we are told and taught that this book was also a revelation from God, and that it is a second testimony of Jesus Christ. So we use it as scriptures along with the Bible, but the emphasis on teachings and learning and principles mainly come from the Book of Mormon and a couple of other scriptures that were canonized that are very unique to the LDS religion. And so the Bible is more or less studied because they do believe in Jesus Christ and they call themselves Christians. But the actual studying of the Bible is very, very surface. So it took my resigning my membership from the church and starting to begin my own search for knowledge and trying to find a purpose and a role for me to begin to even understand the principal characters in the Bible, the apostles or the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, or what were Jesus's actual teachings. I mean, I'm, you know, in my third act of life, my husband and I have been married for 47 years. We attend church weekly, and I still had really no idea who the apostles were or what their purpose was, or even, you know, I knew the general teachings of Jesus, but I knew them through the other canonized scriptures from the LDS church and not directly from the Bible. So the more I'm learning about Christian teachings in general, teachings that are probably more prominent in religions that just study the canonical gospels and use the Bible only, I'm just kind of blown away. And one of the things that really kind of made me shake my head and take a deep breath was from Paul. Now, Paul is a disciple that actually, I don't know if there are any of you that are Christian. I'm just, as I said, I'm just learning these things. So if I make a mistake, please forgive me and please don't be afraid to let me know if I've misquoted something. But Paul was a Jewish and claims to have had a vision of confirmation of Christianity. He was actually on his way to persecute some Christians when he had this vision of Jesus Christ and turned his life over to the teachings of Jesus. So the things that are written, I don't know who, I don't believe they really think that they were written by Paul. I know they don't think that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written by Paul or by those particular disciples that they've been assigned to. So I don't know if they actually think these are writings of Paul. I know that there are scholars who believe that a lot of Paul's writings have been forged. So it's hard to say. But one of the things that he is kind of renowned for is his version of the role of women. And in Corinthians, he says that Christ is the head of the church, his body of which he is the Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church, without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In this same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, people have never hated their own bodies, but they feed and care for them, just as Christ does the church. And then in one other scripture in Corinthians 11, he says, every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head, but every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. It is the same as having her head shaved. For if a woman does not cover her head, she might as well have her hair cut off. But if it is a disgrace for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, then she should cover her head. A man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God. But woman is the glory of man. For man did not come from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for women, but women for man. And those are the kind of teachings that are softened and maybe a little whipped cream sprinkles and cherry put on top, and then taught in most Christian denominations of what the role of women is. And specifically, I believe, and this is just my own opinion, but I believe that they soften the blow of telling women that they really have no purpose than to serve their men, is to say, but guys, you should be really nice to your women. So they're here to serve you because you are in the image of God. But women, so really, I mean, come on, treat them really nice. And the better you treat them, then, you know, that's going to make it better for you. Because after all, treat them like you would treat your own body, because you treat your body because you are like God. And there's this just way of framing it and turning it around. And the sad thing is, as a member of the Mormon Church, we were taught that. And they softened it in ways of saying, you know, like, you're equal, but let me tell you how you're equal. It's almost a form of segregation, where you've got that equal but separate mentality, where you're the same, but here's your roles. And really, you're not allowed to go here, and you're not allowed to speak there. But we love you. We just love you. And we appreciate you. And we're going to give you things. And that should make you happy. Because that's what a loving man does, is he gives things to his family. And then they look back and they go, thank you. And you can just see the hypocrisy in that. So, I mean, it's amazing, though, as women, and even as a young bride myself, hearing those teachings, you're so excited to, you know, find your companion, and you're so in love, and the idea of starting a family is so just exciting that you're like, yeah, yeah, that sounds great. I'd be so happy to do your laundry and make food and clean up, throw up in the middle of the night. I can't think of anything I'd rather do. And it just takes kind of an awakening, like Sue Monk Kidd talked about. It takes almost a maturity for you to kind of have your brain come together, and then you kind of go, wait a minute here. I think I had some things I wanted to do, and I think I had a purpose here on earth. And that's when you start kind of going, wait a minute. And one of the things that's really exciting about what Sue Monk Kidd said was that for white women especially, when they began to get involved in the segregation movements and the horrible suffering that was going on with the different races that was happening in the 60s, and they had to be awakened. And when they began to see the suffering that was going on for the people that, my brain is gone, but for the people that were being subjected, all people in all colors and all different climates of the world, when they began to see people of all different colors being subjugated, and it was an awakening for the white women too, to go, wait a minute, there is an injustice, and there needs to be an awakening for all of the people that are not being treated equally. And so she talked about a couple of women, and I didn't write it down, but a couple of women that actually lived very near her in, I think it was in South Carolina, that were very involved in the abolitionist movement, and how they were then treated by their neighbors and their family, and how they were ostracized and kind of, you know, looked down upon for their activity in helping other people in their community that were marginalized. And so, but by doing that, it helped awaken them to what else, who else is being marginalized in our society. And so they didn't have to look very far to look at where women were and what their place was and how they were looked upon. So I love the way she put that. And I love the idea that that no matter how or why or when in time there is a group of people that have been marginalized, it needs to be addressed, and it needs to be considered. And I One of the things that I think is really hard is trying to put a superiority on the marginalized, like who has it worse? Well, you know, this group might be a little marginalized, but we're more marginalized. And it's that kind of comparative victimhood that creates, I think, some of the anger in communities. And I think it's created a lot of division when people can't have empathy for all people that are subjugated or marginalized and have to have some kind of a priority put on it, where if we just take all of it and look at each individual case equally and then say we have to address all of the instances. So I want to do a little book club with Sue Monk Kidd. You know, oftentimes when you've read a book, you get together with a group of friends and you talk about it. And you talk about, you know, how the book affected you or what are some things that you really liked about the book. So in the back of the book, in a lot of the books that I've read lately, they have like a little book club type of thing. So the first question is, in the introduction to The Dance of the Dissident Daughter, you let your readers know what you would like for them to take away from the book. You say, my hope is that the book will be an opening for you, that something in these pages will make a tiny explosion in your heart, and that you will see the things you've hungered for all along as a woman. What is it about the dance that agitates or creates a need and desire for change? And this is what she says. I believe what sparks passion is that the book is introducing readers to the lost history of the sacred feminine and to the jolting idea that God can be visualized in feminine ways. The first time you really get that, it turns your world upside down. You rarely see a lukewarm reaction to it. The book is also pointing women home to a lost place in their own soul. That may be a part of it too. Whatever it is, it has been moving for me to see readers respond like they have. At book signing events for my novels, The Secret Life of Bees and The Mermaid Chair, there were always women who showed up clutching The Dance of the Dissident Daughter. Sometimes they would break into tears when they asked me to sign it. I know this is not about me, and it's not even about the book, except in the sense that the book opens something for them. The reaction is about them, about their own waking experience. And I think that's what I love about the book, is that because women are in different acts, different seasons of their life, they are going to react to this book differently. And they're going to find, it's kind of like, have you ever attended like a concert or listened or gone to some kind of a moth presentation where they have these fabulous speakers, and you'll be talking about it with your friends afterwards, and you'll say, oh, I loved it when they said this, or I loved it when they said that. And they'll say, I didn't hear that, or I didn't hear anybody say that. And it's because it kind of hit you in a certain way, and you heard something described or explained in a way that hit you, and the other people didn't even hear it at all. So I'm trying to find a quote. I have a quote from Richard Rohr that I want to find. Let me find this quote, and then we'll come back. Let me take another little break, and then I'm going to find this fabulous quote by Richard Rohr, because it relates very well to what Sue Monk Kidd was talking about when she was mentioning finding the feminine divine. Okay, let's take a break.
Welcome back to Go Gray Dame on Talk Zone. Once again, here's Renee Steelman.
I'm still kind of searching for this quote from Richard Rohr, but I'll just paraphrase it. Basically, he talks about how the feminine divine is a little bit frightening for men to think about, because there is a power within women that I don't think men understand. And I really do believe it's frightening, which explains the burning of the witches in Salem, right? which actually the more I've read about it is there weren't that many people burned, but it's a great story and it serves its purpose. But, you know, I also really, Outlanders. Did you guys watch that series? Oh, it was so good. But I loved that the, you know, you've got this woman that goes back in time. She's a doctor. And so she's been thrown back in time, but she still has all of her knowledge. And so she's using it to heal people. And so she gets accused of being a witch and she's going to be burned. And there's a trial. And it's really a fun series to watch. But anyway, but that's why the women, I think intuitively, a lot of times they were the ones that were the herbalists and they were the ones that were taking care of the children and things. And so they learned how to use poultices and herbs and different foods and drinks and all kinds of things to heal people. And that was confusing. And it began to be looked on as like, you guys must be magic or something. And it did create kind of a fear. And that's what she's talking about when she's talking about finding the feminine divine. I also think there is a reverence for the birthing process, carrying a child, giving birth to a child, that is just confusing. And it is an awesome experience. And there is a little bit of kind of wonder in that. But Suma Kidd in her book, she is the one that introduced me to the different searchings that you might come across for the feminine divine. The next question in the book is, did you always get this kind of passionate reaction to the Dance of the Dissonant Daughter? And she said, no, not always. In the beginning, there was also resistance. One of the more memorable instances of that was in 1996, the year Dissonant Daughter came out. I was speaking about the book at a spiritual formation conference that was being held at the mother house of a community of Catholic sisters. I should mention that they were not sponsoring the conference, only providing the facility for it. It was attended mostly by Protestants and an equal portion of men and women, and it turned out that more than a few of them were not happy about my topic. A lot of controversy got stirred up. One afternoon, while seeking refuge in the library, I was summoned to the office of one of the sisters and found myself standing before an elderly nun in full habit. She had her arms crossed over her chest. She did not look happy. She said, "I understand you've been speaking about the divine feminine." I said, "Yes, ma'am." Then she said, "And I also understand you've kicked up quite a hornet's nest." I nodded. "Well," she said, "I just wanted to tell you that it's high time people realize that God is more than two men and a bird." Then she gave me the most wonderful, submersive smile and sent me back into the fray. I've never forgotten her. So yes, there were pockets of antagonism along the way, but I have to tell you, there was also from the very beginning an audience who passionately embraced the book. And you know what I think is funny? This was in 1996. So it's now, you know, 2021, and you would think with technology and as far as we've come with enlightenment of space travel and things like that, that there would be more of an acceptance of talking about the feminine divine. But in my former religion, the Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, there is a lot more talk of a feminine divine, a mother in heaven, a God, a companion to God that is female. And this is being acknowledged, but also put down. And ironically, as she talked about those nuns, there is a very, very well-known scholar within the church who happened to be also speaking at a conference, just like Sue Monk Kidd was, with a group of people who were, I believe they were all Mormons or LDS members. And she talked about the feminine divine, and she talked about the feminine God and the importance of having a feminine authority figure in the Godhood. And she was immediately let go of her position in a scholarly organization and has not commented on it directly, has kind of beat around the bush about it, has not addressed the issue directly, because I'm sure, I have no idea why she hasn't. I'm just going to guess that there's a lot of involvement in her career and in her family and in her status as a scholar to be able to say much. But the idea that there is a feminine God or there is a feminine divine is still not accepted. And it's amazing when you go on the scouting trips that Sue Monk Kidd went on, and she mentions in her book of Finding the Feminine Divine, how the feminine was actually revered and worshiped in past ancient scripture, but eventually, because of the patriarchy and the authority and the obedience that's needed when you have a large organization, she was definitely shushed and put down and put away, and a new role prescribed for what women's role was. And if you are a believer in Jesus Christ, even if you don't believe in his godhood, even if you believe that he was a rabbi or a great teacher, whatever good you can find in his role, a lot of the studying that I've done, there's even doubt whether he even existed or even if there was a Jesus Christ. But if you follow the story and want to believe that there was a rabbi or a great teacher who was trying to open the minds of the people and teach them that it's not important what you eat or what you wear or how many steps you take on Sunday. What's more important is how you treat your fellow men and how you treat your neighbors and how you treat your family and how important it is to be kind and charitable and how charity is the number one principle that you should be looking at, and how all of the different religions, the Buddhist and the Hindu and all of these other religions, talk about charity and love and acceptance, and how marginalizing people in any way is not acceptable. If you want to just go along with that, you have to look at the number of women that were followers of Jesus Christ and how Mary was his number one apostle, and how he shared things with her. If you believe in that story, he shared things with her that he did not share with his apostles, the other male apostles, and how they struggled with that because of their Jewish understanding of what woman's role was, from apostles and disciples like Paul, who taught that women should be silenced and they should be quiet. And that was then taught as a principle of a religion, but was never taught by Jesus Christ. And that's the part that's so frustrating, is to see followers of Jesus Christ take a Jewish, old Jewish principle and then convert that into the teachings of Jesus. And it's been so detrimental, where women have been just patronized and treated so poorly in the name of righteous subjection. And so, you know, another person that I love and I love to quote is Richard Rohr. And he talks about different stages of religion and what's needed as a child and what's needed as an adolescent and then what's needed as an adult. And he says, quote, early stage religion tends to focus on cleaning up, which is to say determining who meets the requirements for moral behavior and religious belief. But Jesus threw a wrench into this whole machinery by refusing to enforce or even bother with what he considered secondary issues like the Sabbath, ritual laws, purity codes, membership requirements, dress codes, and on and on. He saw they were only human commandments, which far too often took the place of love. And I love that quote, because that's what's happened, is people have taken religious quotes and then turned them into principles that need to be obeyed. And then they've created an obedience system that they then can judge and mark you on. And I believe, unfortunately, that women have held the majority of those judgments. When I look at the strict Hasidic Jewish sect and the clothing that they wear, and how women are required to cover their hair, cover their elbows, their skirts are long, even in activities, if they're hiking or exercising, they have to wear leggings underneath their long skirt and then a long underneath garment that covers their elbows and then something over that and their head covered. And then I see their male companion with them in a pair of basketball shorts and a t-shirt. It's so unfair. Or, you know, even the idea in my own religion, in different rituals where women were required to veil their faces, cover their hair, and then LDS people who are married or take out certain ritual covenants in the temples are then required to wear clothing, underwear underneath their regular clothing. And this underwear is very restrictive, more restrictive for women than it is for men. Women's clothing is designed differently. Women's bodies are designed differently. And to try to put the same style of underwear on a woman as is constructed for a man does not work. The fabric doesn't work. And of trying to find clothing that covers up this sacred ritual garments is not the same. It's very, very difficult. So I see this same patriarchy being carried forward in a supposedly modern religion that supposedly was restored from Jesus's teachings, when in actuality, Jesus never taught that, never talked about wearing certain kinds of clothing. That was an Old Testament practice. So very, very interesting. Definitely taking me on a path that is frustrating for some and enlightening for others. So, but like Sue Monk Kidd's husband, when she was having her struggle with her religion, he also followed her and respected her new journey and kind of went along on the journey, not necessarily by her side, but I think eventually by her side, just as my husband has done. So one of the pilgrimages that she took was she talked about going to Greece, and she talked about going to France, which is on my list of things. In fact, I have a trip planned in May of next year to go to Greece to do some feminine divine searching of my own. But she said, the question in the book club was, how did you encounter the Black Madonna? And she said that actually came about during one of her pilgrimages. I first saw her in Greece when I came upon an icon of a dark-faced Madonna. I became intrigued and began seeking her out. I found her especially prevalent in France. The Black Madonna was probably the most impacting discovery I made during those pilgrimages. I never expected her to seize my imagination and even my heart the way she did. All I know is that I became deeply affected by her images and her history. In a way, she's the inheritor within Western religion of the great goddess of the ancient world. I find her to be an extraordinary fusion of the Christian Mary and the old goddesses. And because of that, she has some very unique layers of meaning. Her sense of justice and inclusion, her dissidence, her immense compassion, her connection to the earth and the body, there's something wonderfully untamed about her. She became a kind of bridge for me, an image of the sacred feminine that began to integrate my experience. And I love that she used the word untamed. And I know that Glennon Doyle was a Sue Monk Kidd fan, and probably, who knows, if she actually, if that little quote of using the word untamed, if you, after you get through reading The Dance of the Dissident Daughter, I really suggest reading Untamed by Glennon Doyle. She is another hero of mine and has really opened up the ability and also inspired people to take on their awakening and find their feminine divine. So thank you so much for joining me today. I hope that you found this inspiring. Next week, Oh, and by the way, I forgot to mention, we were going to be doing an every other week, but we've decided this is so much fun. We're going to do a podcast every week. So every Thursday at noon, you will find us. And next week, I'm going to be talking to a wonderful woman who is going through an awakening. The week after that, I have another little bit younger, but we're going to let her slide here, talk about her experience of coming from a fundamental religion and also finding herself within her existence. So it's going to be some really good. So I'm excited to bring on some wonderful guests. I even have some guests from across the pond. So look forward to talking with you next week. And I just can't encourage you enough to go, Grey Dame. Bye-bye.